Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is the 10th of April when you're listening to this. We're recording this on the 8th, which I'm not even doing the disclaimer. Who cares? Nothing will happen in 2 days. But, you know, if something does, and that's why we have a gap here. Today we have a repeat guest. We have Danny Bessner. Danny, I didn't even ask you for your bio, but like I know you as a screenwriter and I know you as a professor. Is that correct?
Yeah. Wow. Thanks for calling me. That's very nice. I'm a professor and I've got the, I'm co-host of the American Prestige podcast, right, which is now syndicated with The Nation. And actually 2 days from now, go back 2 days. I just published a piece on Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. People should check that out.
Oh, wait, you know what? We can talk about that because I think enough time will have passed where it's not within the spoiler zone when this comes out. Like if this came out right now on Monday morning, I feel kind of bad about it. But did you guys see the finale last night?
I actually have not seen it, but I've read about it. I'm going to watch the last two or three episodes.
Okay, fine, then let's not talk about Tyler. Did you watch it?
No, dude, I am. Curb is something I can't get into, which is a like constant source of shame for me. I don't know. I realize it's like very smart and I'm supposed to like it, but I just, yeah, I don't know. I haven't made enough of a run at it, but yeah, one day.
Last week I had on my friend John Gans and I wanted to get somewhat to the center of what was going on with this fascism debate. It was one that I had followed, but not so closely, right? I had sort of followed it passively on social media, and obviously I'd read a piece that Andrew Morantz, one of my colleagues at The New Yorker, had written, which did a good job, I think, talking about a book that had come out, but also in a lot of ways kind of familiarizing The New Yorker's audience with what the stakes of the debate were and who the players were, right? And so this week I wanted to have Danny on to talk about the other side. I think some people in our Discord mentioned it. And, you know, Danny, thank you for, I almost feel like William F. or something like that.
I'm in the firing line.
Yeah, you're in the fire zone. Dun, dun, dun. But, I'm going to just start out by asking, you know, like what for you, right, who is on the we should not. I don't, this is a crass way to put it, but to say, you know, that the word fascism is not a good descriptor of this, right? Of what is happening. Fair. Like what are the stakes of this debate? Because I think for a lot of the audience, and at least for me sometimes, it feels almost a bit abstract, right?
That's fair. And I think it's a really good question to start with, what actually are the stakes? So maybe the way that I view the fascism debate, and of course, this is idiosyncratic as any individual perspective would be, is that there's two broad sort of buckets to think about it in. One is analytical, which is, does what is happening in the United States now meaningfully resemble fascism? And then one would then have to define what one means by fascism. And then there's the sort of political bucket that one could fit it into, which is this effective political action, effective political rhetoric? And those oftentimes are related, but I do think that they are distinct. So in terms of the stakes of it, I think just, you know, from a basic, almost historical materialist perspective, you have to correctly diagnose and identify a movement or a situation if you want to combat it. And if you misidentify or misdiagnose what's going on, your response to whatever you're trying to combat will not be as effective as opposed to if you were to accurately identify it. So I think those are the stakes, right? If it's fascism that leads toward a series of particular responses, and we could look toward the past and we could say, oh, the Popular Front worked or it didn't work, or this didn't work in Weimar or this didn't work in Italy. But if it's something else, and you would necessarily have different ways to approach and combat that situation. But I should add, I don't think this is necessarily a first order concern, either analytically or in terms of popular politics. I don't think that the presidential election or the future of the United States hinges on how this debate turns out. I just don't think that's true. But it is interesting, as I think my friend Danny Steinmetz-Jenkins made clear in his introduction to his volume, Did It Happen Here? And I'll put on the record, that was my title. I suggested that to him and Danny will admit it. But I think it's interesting because it's actually allows you a window into other things besides just the identification of whether it's fascism and whether it's a useful term or not.
Right. It's an interesting way to think about how do we actually apply history, how broadly, how narrowly, and to what end. Tyler, I actually don't know this, you know, the answer to this. Where do you fall in this debate? I'm sure it's one that you've followed, given that I mean, we all kind of followed it, right?
Like, given where you're unfortunate enough to be on academic Twitter.
Where do you end up on this? What side are you on?
Yeah, I tend not to think it's especially productive as a descriptor for.
Hey, you got to say A or B.
Well, if B is not fascism, I'm on B. I don't know. Okay. I don't think it's helpful for a bunch of reasons. There's obviously elements of Trump space that have like what are clearly fascist tendencies. But on the whole, I don't think it's helpful as a descriptor of like the mainstream or like the core of the Trump movement. I mean, I have, you know, acquaintances, friends, whatever, that are Trump supporters from home. And I don't think like much of their politics are described by fascism. I think they're often like either low information people or just like they're just Republicans that are like holding their nose, you know? And so I don't know. I do think there are like a concern I have is that I think it's like radicalizing in a kind of opposite way when like you have these pundits who talk about, you know, like like half of the country is supporting a fascist. I think that like makes it seem as though, you know, Democrats and people on the left are just painting with this like broad brush to characterize anybody who's not like a kind of normie Dem as just like some kind of, you know, bloodthirsty totalitarian goon.
Okay. So let's move a little bit away from the sort of intellectual part of it, right? And into the political part of it, because I think that's where the conversation will be more interesting, or at least, you know, because in terms of comparing historical points, like it's not some, Danny, it's something you're an expert on, right? And it's something that you've done quite a bit of work on. But I think that it'll be something that, like that part of the debate, I think is a little bit, that is the part that I think is more like confined to academia, right? Where
could I just say why that I think is, we don't have to talk about it, but why I think it is fruitful, at least in some context, is because I think it allows one to really focus in on what they think drives history. So if you'll notice, someone like Jason Stanley, who I think his book is called How Fascism Works, from what I recall, I had a debate with him, but he focuses a lot on like rhetoric, and it makes sense because he's a philosopher of language, right? And so by focusing on rhetoric, I think you're able to really identify like similar usages or similar frameworks that are adopted by not only Trump, but one would argue, I would argue, a lot of American politicians, both after and one might even say before fascism. So that might lead that it might not be useful. But I think what a lot of people on my side of the debate really focus on is less rhetoric and more what one might say are the structuring conditions that allowed a fascist political movement, fascist political movements to succeed when they did, which is why you'll often hear people talk about, well, there's no World War One, or there's no powerful left, or capitalism really isn't in crisis. Because for people like myself, and I do think many on my side, it's the structuring conditions that are more important than things like the rhetoric, right? Which is not a surprise considering that a lot of us are at the very least influenced by Marxist analysis or sociological analysis and as opposed to other things. So that is where that is most interesting, because I think it does show how people analyze history and compare histories. So I just wanted to get that point out if we're going to leave.
Oh yeah, no. Behind. That makes sense. Actually, we can dwell on it a little bit longer, because I think you're right. I think that there's some meat on the bone there, which is, so just, you know, as a person who is brought on to sort of summarize the distinctions here, right? Like you went over it quickly, but like what are the key differences in terms of what the setup is, right? Both from a historical economic standpoint between then and now.
Sure.
You mentioned World War One. You mentioned, you know, capitalism and crisis.
I'll give you the best summary, Jay. To me, the three ones that I highlight are, I think, World War One, and that experience of world-ending violence and trauma that was experienced by both soldiers on the front, but also home populations who lost an incredible number, of people, creating sort of the psychic conditions for fascism are is actually really crucial. Whatever you can say about the United States today, there isn't the equivalent of a world-ending war. And I say world-ending because that really is the final nail in the coffin of the European aristocracy, you know, finishing a process that began with the French Revolution or the American Revolution and ended, you know, in 1918 with the, you know, the forced abdication of the Kaiser. So that sort of thing didn't happen. You don't have, you know, roving gangs of veterans with combat experience throughout Europe's capitals. And I actually think that's a crucial recruiting base for was a crucial recruiting base for early fascism. I also think it's difficult to imagine the success of fascism without a very powerful left-wing movement, either communist or socialist. Obviously, communism is basically a non-thing today, and the socialism in the United States is properly, to a significant degree, viewed best as a form of New Deal liberalism that had socialistic elements. It's not sort of the SPD of Weimar, right? Mm-hmm. Which in some senses had genuinely revolutionary elements. That's just not the case. And this is something that I often add to the discussion, and I'm not sure this is as popular amongst other people on my side, so I'll confine it to me. But I also think when you're looking at the history of state development, or we call it here the field of American political development, I think the literal American state in 2024 and for decades before that is not capable of being taken over in the same way that a more immature state was, let's say, in Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s. I think the state is far too complex. The bureaucracy is far too complex. Power is really diluted across many different nodes in a way that's just very different from the realities of what a state was in the 1920s and the 1930s. Kind of related to that, I guess this is a fourth one, is that I don't think we live in a mass political age. And I think fascism is a mass political form. You know, you think about the classic images, goose-stepping soldiers, Nuremberg rallies, gigantic Nuremberg rallies, rallies throughout Nazi Germany. And I just don't think politics functions in the way that it did in the rise of advent of mass politics in the 20s and the 30s. I think it's, again, we have a much more alienated politics and a much more diffuse politics. So to me, those are fundamental structuring characteristics of how fascism came to be that are so disanalogous from anything that's happening in the United States of the 2010s and 2020s that the analogy almost immediately breaks down. Even if you point to a January 6th or the undoubtedly racist rhetoric of a Trump, I don't think that there's enough similarity there to make this comparison a worthwhile one when it comes to the analogy itself. This is why, again, people often point to rhetoric to make the claim, which I think is frankly a weak way to make the argument that it is fascism.
Okay. Tyler, that's very thorough. And actually, you know, I'm not going to say, I haven't heard the other one, so I can't say if it's the best one, but it was the best one we've heard on this podcast so far. Tyler, what do you think about that? You know, like, do you find that you also being somebody, I mean, you're not a historian, but you are an academic, words are something that are important to you as, you know, within your field. Like, what do you think about this sort of just the need to distinguish rhetoric from the structural factors at play here?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I also think the reason we focus on the rhetoric is symptomatic of like broader tendencies on like the left progressive set, which, I mean, I often joke that the left has like what I call the magic spells theory of language, that if we just like get the words right in the jargon and use the right acronyms, that suddenly like the politics will fall into place. And I just don't think that's true. And I'm generally pretty, despite being someone who writes, like disinterested in language politically. And I think you're right, Danny, that there's this focus on the rhetoric at this particular moment, because the left always, or progressives always, focus on the rhetoric, you know, and the rhetoric takes precedence over the material fact. And I think that's kind of what's happening here, where everyone is like, well, look at the words Trump uses. Look at the language he uses to describe immigrants or people of color, talking about bloodbaths and blah, blah, blah. And I think all of it's grotesque and horrifying. But at the same time, I kind of think we had 4 years of this and it was terrible and awful. And it was annoying to have to watch CNN constantly to see what awful thing he was doing. But at the same time, we didn't have like fascism then. It's unclear to me why the second time around, magically, you know, a fascist dictatorship's going to click into place. And I think you're totally right. I mean, the focus is on the language because there aren't the other concrete material changes you can point to that show that we're on the slippery slope toward fascism. Oh, go ahead.
Devil's advocate here, right? Which would say that, you know, there's no way in which after 100 years of passing in two different countries that everything is going to line up perfectly, right? If that was true, then we couldn't make any historical analogies, obviously, because the limits on it would be too tight. And so if you say that we don't have a type of large rally, but we do have, you know, mass media at a scale that we didn't have before, and that a lot of it is rightward pointing and using this troubling rhetoric, and that no, we don't have gangs of ex-military people roving the streets of the Capitol, but we did have January 6th, right? Like that is a thing that did happen, and we do have like those dudes in khakis walking around. I don't know what's their name. I always forget. Like national, like it's not National Front, obviously.
But it's the Proud Boys. It's not the Proud.
No,
it's
there's the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys.
Right, right. The Proud Boys, and then we have those dudes who wear masks.
The Boogaloos.
Yeah. And I will say that their numbers are quite small, right? Like almost like small enough where you can kind of dismiss it, and that if it, you can also argue, which I have in the past, but I don't know how I feel about it anymore. But in the past, I had argued that like these are liberal creations in a lot of ways, right? That they exist to scare liberals in the way that liberals want to be scared. But in terms of an actual threat, that the best thing that we can do is pay attention to them. Like, do you remember like this moment in media where literally every story was about, it felt like every story was like Milo Yiannopoulos. And I was like, who the fuck is this guy?
The fuck is this guy?
Yeah. And like, he was, everything was like, oh, he's so dangerous. I feel the same way about Alex Jones in a lot of ways. I find Alex Jones to be obviously quite repulsive, but right, like the media has turned Alex Jones into Alex Jones. And I think they're kind of doing it with Elon Musk right at this point too. But at least Elon Musk is really rich. You know, the rest of these guys are just kind of small fries. But even given that, right, like they do exist, right? And so is, like, I think that one of the ways in which I think that somebody like the people who say, look, you can't demand this tight of a definitional corollary, like, right, we just have to kind of have things that are in the same spirit that are concerning, and that the rhetoric does matter because it is the one thing that can actually go across eras, right? Like where it can kind of sound the same. But yeah.
So a couple of quick answers. I think you then have to look to, is there an alternative explanation that's more effective than going to a European phenomenon like fascism? And to me, just, you know, horrible American racism, you know, right-wing populism are strong traditions in this country that one could more directly link to Trump, just flat out, you know? So there's a better explanation than fascism in my read. And not everyone needs to have that read or should have that read. That's my understanding of American history. I think Trump more organically emerges from them, from, you know, right-wing populism and American xenophobia and racism than he does from fascism. People could disagree about that. Then I also think you mentioned January 6th. Well, that was the test case. What did the generals do, right? I mean, did they support the attempt to delay the election and to install Trump? No. When Trump was actually in office, did he actually govern like a fascist dictator? I would say no. This is not to excuse or support the brutal and awful things that Trump did, but it's just to say that he flat out didn't govern like a Mussolini or a Hitler. So at some point, looking at this question should ask themselves, is there a better genealogy from which one can derive Trump? And did the actual time in office reflect what a Hitler did? Was, for example, an enabling act passed? Did Trump make political parties that were against him illegal? Did he pass a version of the Nuremberg laws, which, you know, Hitler did in 1935? And that's what fascists did in power. So then if people still think that it's a useful analogy, that is up to them. I can't dictate what they say or what they believe. But to me, it's very disanalogous, and there's better alternative explanations.
Well, what would you call it then, right? Like, would you call it Trumpism? Would you call it, like, what you would drop back to You said sort of right-wing populism.
I think it's right-wing populism. You know, there's Huey Long. There's going back to the 1890s. Mm-hmm. There are elements of this, like going back to the early Republic and these various anti-federalist rebellions. And so I think that is a much stronger tradition. Now, I wanted to say one quick thing. The fascism thing is interesting as it relates to liberalism, because at least I am of the belief that one of the ways that liberal democratic capitalism justified itself as the hegemonic ideology of the United States after 1945, when it was, you know, very powerful beforehand, but there were genuine like left-wing alternatives, and there were also like right-wing alternatives, more libertarian, is that it justifies itself through the defeat of fascism, right? And I think Bruce Kuklick, in his recent book, Fascism Comes to America, does a very interesting historical explanation, where at least according to what Kuklick argued, as I interpreted it, was that the political spectrum of left to right really only becomes popular in this country in the middle of the 20th century and after World War II. And part of the reason was for liberals to like the liberal democratic capitalists who were in like the New Deal administration, was to identify themselves as the moderate center against an extremist left, which they had in communists going back to 1917, and then an extremist right, which really only arises in the minds of Americans with fascism. So this is the founding moment. Anti-fascism is the founding moment for liberalism itself, which is why I think the debate has become so acrimonious. I mean, academic debates do tend to become acrimonious, but it's really a discussion about liberalism and liberalism suitability going into the future. And I actually think liberalism is in crisis, because the end of the Cold War was defined by the idea that liberal hegemony, liberal democratic capitalist hegemony now and forever, but it so obviously failed to deliver on the great promises of basically bringing everyone up and, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. So discussions about fascism are actually, in some sense, not only about the analogies that I was talking about, but are ersatz discussions about liberalism itself, which is why, again, I think one of the reasons it's become so acrimonious, and obviously, like, people, there are individuals and people get mad at each other, as happens in many debates as well.
In terms of, you know, as a man, I've gotten to know you pretty well over the past 6 months or so. And I think that one of the things that I would say is that you think a lot about ways in which the left should define itself, right? And what it should use to define itself and what it should not. And you have a piece that we're going to discuss later on in the show that is in a lot of ways about that, right? Like, that's sort of the central question of what you're doing, which is just like, should the left, should liberals cling to this kind of elitist vision of, here we are, all the educated people, and everyone else is stupid, and that's why the country is bad, right? Which is it's a real thing. I mean, I think that MSNBC is basically predicated upon that idea. It presents a sort of mythic or at least very cosmetic version of, here are all the smart, diverse people in the world, and we all love each other, and we like all sort of worship at the same altars. And everyone who doesn't is a racist or a bigot or hates trans people or hates, you know, doesn't like democracy. That's a new thing that they're doing, just shoving it down people's throats. Like, if you don't agree with us, the multicultural commentariat, then you don't believe in democracy anymore, right? And we have to do democracy. The question that I have is, like, do you think it is, I think that part of what Danny is saying is true, that this is really just about the crisis of liberalism and what liberalism is going to be in its way. And anytime liberalism is in crisis, then the left has an opportunity to define itself in some sort of way. What opportunity do you see then here?
The opportunity that you have, given the foil of Trumpism, is that you have a population of people on both the left and various sectors of the right who are very frustrated with the sort of neoliberal status quo, who are thinking very differently about sort of what government's role should be in intervening in the economy, et cetera. And, you know, for people on the right, particularly, you know, rural people or people that live in the middle of the country, a lot of that has to do with the history of deindustrialization and so on. And so there are different sort of factors driving it than I think the economically minded folks on the left. But nonetheless, it seems like an opportunity where like a lot of different kinds of people agree that there's a problem with how our economy operates. And, you know, there are section of people who think Trump has the answers to that, which I obviously resolutely disagree with. But I think, you know, the bigger point for me is that, you know, there is a burgeoning sense that like this, the status quo does not work. And that seems like a really important opportunity. And one of the reasons why I think it's so important to not just like paint all Trump supporters with a broad brush is, you know, I lived in a part of the country that flipped from Obama to Trump. I have friends and family members who went from Obama to Trump. They didn't get racist and they weren't motivated by, you know, racial concerns. They were motivated by 2008 and the opioid crisis and a bunch of things like that, you know. And to me, if those folks who moved from Obama to Trump, and it's always worth remembering, Obama had a much bigger sort of more robust economic message, sort of not neoliberal economic message than he ended up enacting as a president. But, you know, if those people move from Obama to Trump, I think there's a certain subset of people that can move back, you know. And so I just think it's really important not to, you know, rhetorically alienate those people immediately by, you know, signaling that any person who perhaps voted for Trump in 2016 or 2020 is, you know, an anti-democratic, you know, bloodthirsty fascist. You know, I think we have to hold out some, because I don't want to align at the end of the day with like the normie, wealthy, suburban, you know, Wall Street Democrats. Like, that is not my cup of tea. I don't think that pathway is going to lead to a better country. And just in terms of like cobbling together a coalition of people that want the economy to work differently, it seems very obvious to me that, you know, we have to find a way to bring some of those, like, you know, center right populists back into the fold, not the racist ones, not the 3%ers and not the Proud Boys. But yeah, I don't know. It just, yeah, go ahead, Danny.
I got Danny.
Just very quickly, I hopefully have a piece coming out about this in a few days, co-written with Danny Steinmetz Jenkins. But I think this is why apocalyptic rhetoric is not a friend to the left in this political moment. I think that fascism talk is a subspecies of apocalyptic rhetoric that has been very popular in American political discourse, as you both know, going back to before the Republic was even founded, right? Mm-hmm. We've had several great awakenings that are permeated with apocalyptic rhetoric, and evangelicals, Christians, when they've entered into politics since the 70s, have also used apocalyptic rhetoric. And I actually think that in history, when liberals use apocalyptic rhetoric, it's actually a means to shut down left-wing critics and heterodox thinking. And so ultimately, I think that is one of the potential problems, one of the several potential problems with fascism talk itself, particularly because I would argue, I wrote about this in my first book, I think since 1945, since the end of World War II, liberal democratic capitalism has justified itself as the moderate center, as I talked about, but also prevented more radical social democratic programs by appealing to ideas of crisis. People literally talk about this. You know, when people are writing in the late 1940s and 1950s about the Cold War, they're talking about the Soviets got their bomb in autumn 49, China, quote unquote, fell to the communists. They're like, there's now an international crisis. So we can't do a lot of those more radical things we were talking about in the 30s until we have defeated the Soviet Union and international communism when it comes to the People's Republic and elsewhere. But they also say is that once this conflict is over, we'll be able to re-embrace these sorts of radical experiments of the 1930s. But what I think the last 30 years have shown is that for whatever reason, liberalism is incapable of not existing in a crisis state. It's incapable of saying, okay, the Soviets were defeated. Communism, you know, totalitarianism, quote unquote, is now defeated. Now we could return to like large social democratic programs.
You don't think that the second Obama term was liberalism not in a crisis state? Like, I don't, you know, we all live through that. I agree right now, right? And I agree with Bush. It certainly was the first. I mean, I think young people don't remember this, but I have this distinct memory of the Bush-Gore election and coming in, and everyone at my school was I was in graduate school at this point, but everyone was crying, you know? And I was like, mm-hmm. Well, I was just like, all right, wow. You know, it's like, I understand the sense of crisis for those, but you don't feel like the Obama years were a period of time when liberalism existed without crisis?
No, I mean, if you look, they bailed out Wall Street and not, I mean, there were such percolating crises, whether you look at the drone war and the Obama's continuation of the international war on terror to the gigantic political economic crisis that Obama didn't solve, right? So I actually, and that was recognized at the time, right? Why does millennial socialism take off during Obama's second term, right? To me, liberalism has, that was a period of liberalism in crisis, even if from its most elite perches, it didn't feel that way. I mean, that's Jay, that's Occupy Wall Street, you know, that's actually taking on liberalism head on in a way that hadn't been done since 1935. Oh, yeah.
What I meant was like, because they were in power, right? Like they didn't, they didn't broadcast the crisis, even if the crisis exists.
You're talking about liberals. Yes, yeah, 100%. Yeah, I agree. Right. Sorry. My apologies. Yes.
No. So maybe it's almost like what's interesting right now is that the liberals are in power, right? And they are still, their message is still a message of crisis. And that's a part that I found to be like quite interesting because I don't know, you know, somebody wrote I think it was Damian Linker or something like that, wrote a op-ed today in the Times, and it was about what Biden is kind of doing wrong. It was actually an interesting piece. And it was, part of it was just that, like, part of it pointed out that when Biden talks to me about the economy right now, he kind of sounds like Will Stancil or something like that, where he's like, everything's fine, you know?
That's great.
And it's like,
look at my pie chart.
I do think that the economy in some ways is good, right? In a lot of ways is good, but like people really do feel a housing crunch, for example, like that's real, right? And the point is that even if the economy is fine, many people still don't feel that way. And to just have somebody say it's all fine, my only point being not to talk about, get too deep in the woods there, but the main message is not, look how great I made everything. The message is still, if you don't vote for me, then we're gonna have this guy, right? And that part, I agree with you. It's interesting to see that it's actually kind of hard at this point to imagine, now that we're at this point, how liberals will define themselves without that crisis, without the threat of fascism, and without the threat of, you know, people, your nice neighbors ending up in the camps, right? I'm not quite sure how they go back to something that's not that if they have this much power right now and they're not doing that.
Well, Jay, just very quickly, now I get into my historical thing. I'm skeptical, basically, of all social science, and I'm skeptical of whether the macroeconomy is a useful way to literally understand anything.
Sure.
You know, like Tim Shank, I think his dissertation was on like the invention of the economy as an object of social scientific analysis. And that is really like how we understand, how elite liberals in particular understand politics. And I think we're actually like reaching a limit in that sort of framework, which has defined our entire adult lives, sort of explainer journalism. So I think that's really important. And I actually think the fascism debate as embraced by liberals like Rachel Maddow and stuff like that is a very clear sign of liberalism's weakness, because it's a negative case, like you said. It's not a positive case. And I've talked about this actually a bit. Tyler, we talked about this with Glenn and John, right? When I was like, there's a crisis of liberalism. And I really do think that it's actually like, the way that I put it, and you guys could tell me if this is a crank, like God died in the 19th century and ideology died in the 20th, right? People in the 20th century like died for communism, died for liberalism, died for fascism. I don't think that is something that necessarily masses of people will do today, right? So there's this crisis of meaning, which helps lead to a larger crisis of liberalism. And there's just nothing, like no one really believes in large ideological systems. Maybe I'm wrong, but I really think that a lot of the Trump was like alienated bomb throwing as opposed to a belief in something called Trumpism, which one can't even define because Trump is basically an empty signifier and just flits around, though there's some standard things like a racism and xenophobia and a neoliberalism in particular. So I think these things are actually all connected.
I don't know. Ty, what do you think about this? Something that we can start to dovetail into your piece because I think it's related here.
Yeah, actually,
but I do think that one of the things that I find myself in terms of the political veil. Actually, let's go here for a second. In terms of the political valence part of it, right, which is the part that is interesting to me, I find myself leaning more towards what John is saying and terms of electoral politics, which is that I think that it is wrong to ignore a lot of the popular protest movements that have come up. And we can argue, and I think Danny, you and I would probably agree, that I think that the people who say that these have accomplished great things are probably a bit delusional, at this point. But they do are the rallying points that we have, right, in a time when there is, as you said, very little political passion. And that from an electoral results thing, like, it has kind of worked, right? Like, there was no red wave. I think a red wave with some of the people that were running 2 years ago would have been a disaster. I mean, it would have been really bad in some states. We did have millions of people show up to really vote for after Dobbs, right? Like, mm-hmm. that was an animating thing that happened. I think that a lot of the rhetoric that was used there was very popular fronty type of stuff, right? Like, we have to stop this. They're not going to stop here. They're going to keep going. Defining the right as a intrusive and chaotic, and in some ways, I think you could use the word fascist term. And that, I think that when I think about it, and I told John this, and I think I'll just repeat it here, which is that I think I have a somewhat skewed perspective of this because I do live in Berkeley, California, which is it is a vanguard of kind of the intense normie liberal movement, right? People think it's like the vanguard of radicalism, but it's not. It is actually the vanguard of like the most intense MSNBC viewer that you've ever met in your entire life. And so I'm around these people, but you know, they really do believe this argument, right? I think they would be open to a version of liberalism that did have this New Deal stuff like universal healthcare or whatever like that, but that in the end they're just impatient with the left or any type of left that doesn't understand that the most important thing to do is to stop Trump. And that I do think that on, you know, on anything left to the left of center right, that's probably the most like powerful animating political force that we have mm-hmm. right now, and that it shouldn't be ignored.
I've tried to look into this, and maybe I just didn't find it, but I didn't see causal links really there between the rhetoric of defend democracy and then the end of the red wave. That data might be out yet there, and I might not have found it.
But so, that would be the social sciences that we both don't believe in.
So this gets into I mean, thank God Berkeley's going to stay blue though. I'm really worried about that one. But the way to do it would really if we're talking about electoral politics, then look at the swing districts and see right. if this is effective or not. I just don't know if that's the case. I have my doubts that it's particularly motivating. I think the Dobbs is probably mm-hmm. way more motivating than rhetoric about fascism, but it's
I
an
think
open
people
empirical
confuse
question.
Those two because right. so yeah. many people yeah. have painted Dobbs as like a fascist moment, and so I think people are like, well, look, it's
right,
people
but
are responding.
They're kind of lumped into the same bucket of like yeah. we got to stop Trump, don't you think? Right, at least
yeah.
in that sense.
Yeah, sure. But I just yeah. mean like they bleed into each other, and so it's unclear to me like what is people voting against the people who ended abortion and what is like fascism panic.
You know? Right. I guess my question to you, and then we can move on to the white rural thing and rage part. The white rural.
It's impossible to say.
White rural
juror.
Rural juror. Yeah, exactly.
Is I think we all agree Trump is probably the second Trump presidency is more threatening than say like you know what Mitt Romney would have been, right? Or
totally.
Bob Dole, right? And
yep.
That the delusions that some people on the left seem to have that in terms of things like policy in Israel, the idea that Trump would be better than Biden is, you know, it's a little bit hard to take seriously given how erratic Trump is. What is the popular politics then that would acknowledge that but is not divisive and that at mm-hmm. least will keep the importance of this upcoming election in mind in some ways? Like
so Jay, I have a question. I mean, is the only purpose to win the election, or is then like what comes after winning?
No. I am only asking in terms of this, in terms of the election. Right. I agree with you.
So like the problem is that it creates a style of politics that is not conducive to achieving anything that the left wants to achieve. Yeah. Right. So then that's, to me, the question can't just be about the literal voting in the election, but about this entire style of politics. So I guess that would be my response. And then it's up to, you know, political consultants of the Democratic Party to decide if this is useful for the election. But to me, we always focus on the election, and it's not even half the story. It's like 10% of the story.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to think, you know, I'm kind of the mindset that, like, clearly what we're riding with is Dobbs and anti-fascism, and that's, like, baked in, and that's what we're going with for this right. election. And so I'm kind of at this point resigned to that. I am gonna, I'm a registered as a Democrat. I will do, you know, vote for whatever warm body is on the ballot with a D next to it when it comes.
You're in the Southern Maine district, right? You're not in the swing district.
No. Yeah, no,
if you're up in the North Maine woods, then your vote would actually really kind of
count.
Matter.
Yeah. But I mean, nonetheless, like, my thinking is just like, there needs to be some kind of like reckoning and conversation. Like, once this election is over, Trump is going to be way too old to run again. Biden is obviously will be done. There's no one on either side that is like young behind them that is like an obvious Hillary Clinton type to step into the void, you know? And so I think it's a real opportunity to like think differently about political coalitions and like, how can we build something that is more economically radical, you know, by knitting together different kinds of constituencies. But that's like a question for after the election. I just like think we're like, this is the boat we're in. We're going to have to ride the boat. There's clearly Biden is immune to changing his messaging and his team changing the messaging away from like the fascism stuff. So that's what it's going to be, you know? And I think, you know, those of us who have, you know, the talking heads will, you know, make the case for holding your nose and voting for Biden or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, the I'm much more interested in what happens after the election. I'm just like,
yeah, me too.
We got to win. And then, you know,
we can follow in the great footsteps of Bob Avakian, who actually voted for Biden the last time. Well, let's go to the second part of this podcast, which is, Tyler, we've tried to talk about for the last three weeks.
I'm sorry.
But you were not able to publish this piece for a while because for reasons that are not your fault, let's just say, right? Like they're whenever you publish something like this, there's all lawyers and stuff have to get involved.
Yeah, fact checking, right?
You have to also like make sure the things you're saying are right. But you had a big article that came out, and I have been hearing about this for almost a month now. And it is about this book called White Rural Rage. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did I say it correctly this time? White Rural Rage. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and why you ended up, you know, devoting so much time to it, right? Like,
Well, when it came out, I read it immediately and pitched my editor. You know, I
tell us a little bit about what the book is. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So White Rural Rage is a book by Tom Schaller, who is a political scientist, and Paul Waldman, who was a journalist at The Post. And now I think he's on Substack. And it's making the case that white rural Americans are a threat to democracy, both in terms of like electoral politics, which is actually one of the parts of their book that's like pretty, you know, airtight, I think, given the outsized electoral influence of rural places. But more specifically, and what they spend most of their time on is sort of the threat of violence from rural Americans, that they're more homophobic, they're more xenophobic, anti-immigrant, blah, 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 they're anti-democratic, and so on. And that the threat to American democracy is coming out of rural America. And I disagreed immediately upon reading the book with the general, what I saw as a lack of curiosity about like the structural forces that might produce this kind of politics in rural America. So deindustrialization, NAFTA, and so on, which they do, to give them credit, touch on. But it's, you know, they touch on it only to lead with these like psychologizing explanations about like what's wrong with the rural mindset or whatever. But I pitched, you know, a review of this to my editor that was going to be really combined with a personal essay, as someone from Pennsylvania and whose grandparents were, you know, from West Virginia, but who's also a person of color and trying to, you know, think differently about like the structural forces behind these problems. And as I was working on that, you know, review combined with a personal essay, two reviews came out by political scientists. One, this guy, Bikal Muniz, and another, Nicholas F. Jacobs, accusing the book of academic malpractice, you know, pointing out that their work had been used incorrectly and in misleading ways. And with this kind of thing, you know, as Jay, I know you've written about academia, and as you definitely know, Danny, I mean, academics sometimes settle private disputes in their field in public ways, you know? So my gut instinct was like, okay, I don't know how much credence to give these reviews. So I'm just going to start doing some digging. And I had really given these guys a bunch of shit, Waldman and Schaller, on social media. And so I was like, I need to be fair. So the first thing I was going to do, I did, is go to people in the acknowledgements that they thank. Because I figured people they thanked are probably either friends or folks they know, or like who might be more predisposed to, you know, say good things about the book. The first person I contacted wrote back to me almost immediately and said, you know, I'm baffled by your request. I don't know either of these men. I don't work at the university they say I work at. I've never consulted with them for this book, blah, blah, blah. And so that's not off alarm bells. That guy subsequently looked back in his email in the fact check process and found where, you know, originally he had a very brief exchange with them, which he compared, and I quote, he said, them thanking me in the acknowledgments, this is paraphrasing, would be like me thanking the Obama, President Obama, because I had responded to a campaign email he sent, you know.
Burned.
Exactly. But at any rate, so, you know, I started hearing from other people in the acknowledgments that they did not know these people. Had only corresponded with them very briefly, were very surprised to be thanked. A couple of them were immediately critical of the book. And so I started just, I spot checked one chapter. I picked chapter 6, which was about political violence. And I started just looking at the citations, you know, and they, you know, they cite something that claims that rural Americans are more likely to favor, support violence over democratic deliberation. Well, I looked at the study, and that study is not about violence or democratic deliberation. It's about racism. It's a totally different topic. Or they say rural sheriffs are more likely to support anti-democratic, whatever. But, you know, they, the article they cite isn't about rural sheriffs. And in fact, they never prove that anti-democratic sheriffs are more likely to be rural. So I started finding all these persistent errors throughout the book, which is one of the reasons why this took so long. Like, every week I was like, okay, I've finally gotten to the end of the problems with this book. And then I'd find something else. And the real tipping point was after I fact-checked a lot of the citations, I, you know, and realized how many errors there were. I was like, I probably should check to make sure the places they say are rural are actually rural. And so I just picked one section where they list all of these libraries that are, you know, had been assaulted, you know, metaphorically speaking, had been attacked by anti-LGBT activists for having, you know, queer books and stuff. And immediately half of those, some political scientists I interviewed, you know, gave me some databases and tools to check different metrics for reality, rurality. And almost immediately looking at the libraries, I mean, not only were the places they were mentioning, half of them were not simply not rural. They were about as urban. They had, RUCA code, which is one of the ways you can assess rurality versus urbanity of one, which is the most urban, right? And so I realized, started going through a lot of the places they discuss in the book and call rural or not rural at all. My favorite example is Johnson County, Kansas, which they say this rural sheriff from rural Johnson County, Kansas, who's very scary. Johnson County, Kansas is the most populous county in Kansas. It's one of the most urban counties in the entire United States. I think by population, it's like ranked 111. 11th or something like that. Only 4% of the county has any is rural at all, according to the census, which is very, very low. And so, you know, it was clear time and time again, not only are they butchering studies, but that they were calling places, you know, rural that were urban or suburban, and pointing to real problems in those places, but making it out like this was rural America when it was actually suburban America and places in Michigan, 20 minutes from Grand Rapids, or, you know, outside of, you know, Charlotte, North Carolina. But yeah, so
why do you think they're doing this? Danny, also, please jump in.
That was my question. Yeah, I'm like, yeah. So, I mean, why? The case is clear. I feel like if people go through your article, it's very difficult to say that there was serious, I don't want to say scholarly malpractice, but something was happening. Mm-hmm. And Jay, that was my exact, what do you think it's just sloppiness? Do you think that ideology just forced them to do this? Do you think it was willful? I mean, it's difficult to know, but it's a lot of pretty damning evidence.
Yeah, that's, you know, I found it to be, like, I kind of found it, if I didn't know you and I hadn't heard about this, then I think my first response to your piece would have just been like, I don't know, like, you know, it can't be this bad.
Yeah.
You know? But I agree that with Danny, that I'm just like, well, when you actually think about it outside of just like a gut check of like, could it actually be this bad? Mm-hmm. Right? Which is obviously, of course it could be that bad. It's just you kind of expect it not to be because you kind of expect it to just be fall somewhere in the kind of bad, but not that bad type of thing. Then you have to start searching for a motivation, right? So did they get back to you at all? Like, what did they say anything? Like, what's the why do you think this happened? Like, why?
So I think I have a pretty good gut instinct for these kind of things. And I'm, to be honest, totally flummoxed. I fact checked the majority of the book. I also fact checked a chapter about rural minorities where they were trying to make a positive case about, you know, other kinds of rural folks.
These are the good rurals.
The good minorities. Yeah, good rurals. And so curiously, in other parts of the book, they don't seem to run into these citational errors, which is interesting. That it's mainly confined to these places throughout the book where they're trying to convince you that rural people are likely to be, you know, or support violence or whatever. So the fact that they're capable of getting the scholarship right in some sections is suggestive. But even that notwithstanding, I still really think that it was not intentional. I mean, looking at it, you know, I think it would be very easy to say, like, there are these persistent errors. They're of a similar kind, calling places that are rural, urban or suburban, rural. They cite a study that they say, you know, oh, rural people support political violence. And then you go to that study and it actually says suburban people are the most likely to support political violence. So it would be easy to say, like, obviously this had to be on purpose, but my gut instinct is kind of, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if it was, because the errors are persistent, but it strikes me more that they are like a lot of Americans who can't see the facts in front of them, right? Like, it's been known since January 6th that the bulk of people who were behind January 6th, who traveled, were business owners, CEOs, doctors, right. Small-time politicians, right? These were
the petite bourgeoisie, exactly. Who you would
exactly.
Predict.
Yeah. And so,
people who have like really nice trucks.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Right. And I tend dealers, to think, right, like, yeah. America has not metabolized that narrative, even though we know the facts. And we know the facts, but we look past them and we continue to act as though it's these like scary hicks. And I kind of tend to think, if I had to guess, if I had to put money on it, my money would be on, you know, they're just so blinded by this idea that the scary fascist Republicans are over there. They're not where I live. They're not in the suburbs. They're not in DC. They're not in New York. That they can't see the facts accurately. You know, that's kind of my gut.
Which is what one might think is the problem with Manichaean and apocalyptic thinking, because it necessarily puts someone in a category, like they're necessarily the other, so they don't have to be interrogated with the same open-mindedness. And it's a perfect example of the potential problems of fascism talk, or really apocalyptic framing or Manichaean frameworks
absolutely.
Themselves.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. You know, and I mean, even not a single political scientist in this field has defended this. I talked to over 20 of them. All of them were various shades of critical, and some hadn't read the book and didn't comment, but helped me with like matters of fact or like understanding technical terms or whatever. But, you know, I think experts are very much like this book is garbage. But I've had some academics, not many, but I've had a few, because the facts I think are pretty ugly, but I've had some academics be like, well, but we all know rural people are like this, you know? So even people with like PhDs who you would think would believe in following the research and trusting experts and whatever, you can tell them that like all of the people who work in this field say this narrative is misleading or incorrect. And look at all these errors of fact, and still, you know, there is a certain kind of person who's like, yeah, but we know rural people are garbage. So like, we're going to go with our gut here, you know, and that's
Tyler,
one of the things I find distressing.
Question that I had for you is that, do you think this reflects a particular new class stratification of academia where almost no one comes from a rural background? I that 100%. Might have also been true in the 50s and the 60s during the so-called height, but I don't know, but
Sorry. Yeah, man. One thing that was crazy that I learned upon, and one of the reasons this took so long was I spent so much time talking to political scientists, and this field is really small. And actually, to your like new class PMC point, you know, most academics are not coming from rural areas. That you can see that in the size of the field, like rural politics, you would think would be a huge topic in political science, particularly.
It is growing.
Yeah. But you know, I talked to almost everyone in the field. There are a few people I didn't reach out to because at a certain point I had so many, you know, people that were willing to go on the record that it was a moot point. But I talked to almost the whole field. It's not a big field. And I think that speaks to how little So how many academics don't think there's like a live research questions to be asked about rural America? Because we know what's going over there and we know what it's like, and those people are irrelevant, and the ways in which they're relevant is solely because they're bad, you know? But yeah, I do think it's, you know, a kind of out of touchness. And you know, there's a documentary I love that I would recommend anyone watch. It's on Hulu. It's called Hillbilly. And it was filmed by this documentarian from rural Kentucky, from an Appalachian part of Kentucky, who moves back from LA, to cover the election. It's really, really interesting. But there's somebody, in that documentary, who's quoted, and you know, they're a person of color from Appalachia, and they say, you know, every people or every part of the world has their hillbilly, you know, that like they're, and the function of a hillbilly is like an outlet of acceptable rage, right? Like you can't, you know, go take to CNN and say nasty things about folks of color or about, you know, X, Y, or Z. But you have to have some kind of outlet, and almost every society has one. And in America, it's the hillbilly, you know? And I think that's part of this, you know, why, I mean, you could never publish a book called, you know, Urban Black Rage, unless it was positive, right? Like the Righteous Black Rage. Like you just couldn't do it. And you especially couldn't do it in a mainstream press like Random House, by people who are not experts in black politics, without fact checking the book rigorously. It just would never happen, you know?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think that corollary is probably, I think that when you get to the point of like, would it be more scrutinized by those presses? Yeah, I think for sure. I also find it interesting that like how much of this type of thinking goes across, like beyond, or goes against what we already think and other things that we think, right? The most highly publicized sheriff's department, for example, that is clearly anti-democratic and pretty racist and violent, is in the rural rural enclave of Los Angeles, California. You know, like that, yeah. Like it's like,
or that asshole from Phoenix is another one.
Right.
Yeah. Rapo.
Right. No, but and that's something that you pointed out on Twitter that I wanted you to go, you know, yeah. Expand a little bit on, which is that the part that I find distressing about this is not the fact that two people wrote a book that was stupid. Like that happens all the time, you know, and I'm glad that you took it to task, because it's not some small book. I have this thing where if a book is very small, it's very hard for me to like get that mad about it.
Yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
I just think, oh, well, you know, it's kind of unfair, right?
Totally.
But this was a bestseller. It was talked about all the time, and it became kind of like an MS. It confirms the MSNBC mindset, and so
yeah, they showed up on MSNBC. Yeah.
Right, right. It becomes an MSNBC talking point, and it does confirm the whole like, oh, it's them, it's not us. If it was just us, then the world would be, America would be great, and everyone would be equal, and you know, everything in the world would be multicultural, much like this panel, right? But, yeah, like, what do you think the harm is of this in terms of what it obscures?
Yeah, absolutely. So something a number of folks said to me was that, you know, there is a real threat. The first thing I would say is I didn't ask, but some volunteered, and it was pretty clear in other ways. I think almost every political scientist I talked to is someone on the left or a firm Democrat. But you know, what they said is there's a real threat of right-wing violence, but it's not coming from rural places. So in terms of like why this matters, I talked to this guy, Robert Pape, who heads the study at UChicago.
Bob Pape, bombing to win. War on Terror, Bob Pape. That's how
War on Terror,
name.
Bob. Yeah. He so I talked to him. He had this big multi-million dollar study of the January 6th people, and his work is cited, and they cite his work and to prove that, you know, the threat or to suggest, heavily imply that, you know, rural people are more likely to have these insurrectionist tendencies, and we should be worried about them. And what that study says in huge bold letters is the threat of right-wing violence and insurrection is mainly urban, to the tune of 73%, I believe, to 27%. But I talked to Pape and talked to him on the phone a number of times and had a Zoom with him. And he was like, you know, he kept telling me, he was like, yes, they use my work in misleading ways. He was like, you know, if this were an academic tenure case, like this is the kind of thing people wouldn't get tenure for, using studies in these misleading and just error prone ways.
And you got to believe him. He's from the department that doesn't give tenure, University of Chicago Political Science.
Exactly. He knows
very known
about
for that.
So he was like, but that's not the story. Like the academic negligence is not the story. He's like, you can't appreciate enough that like counterterrorism people, FBI people, like politicians, they watch MSNBC, they watch CNN, they read bestsellers, and they assume they're fact-checked and credible. And so when you have this narrative that's not just going out to the public, but going out to people who can make decisions and saying, oh, the threat is over there in Podunk, Llano, Texas, rather than in the suburbs of DC or New York or LA, that's really dangerous because it can lead people to misallocate resources, to not understand the threat. And I won't speak for him. I don't know where he comes down on the fascism debate, but since we were talking about this, you know, I mean, how I read Pape's work is not saying that there's, like, you know, necessarily some huge fascism movement that's going to overtake the US, but if we're thinking about the threat of violence, right, like, there's a lot of people who both believe the election was stolen from Trump and that it's justified to return him by force. And even if just a small percentage of those people carry out acts against the government or whatever, it's a big problem, you know. And so selling this lie that a bunch of poor people in rural areas are who we should be worried about is potentially really damaging.
Jay, do you mind if I ask Tyler a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So Tyler, it's funny. This is exactly what I wanted to ask, because I think in the piece, two or three times you're like, the real danger is from X or Y. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, in your research, have there been people carrying out, like, stochastic acts of random violence from January 6th? Like, what have sort of the right wing researchers actually found? Or has there been a lot of, you know, sound and fury, but not mm-hmm. actual violence? It's genuine. I don't know.
Yeah. So in terms of January 6th, I'm not sure how much violence there has been after it. I do know that I think over 50% of the people in January 6th had basically PMC or petit bourgeois, occupations, right? And which makes sense because they coordinated flights, they arranged buses, some of them flew private, which is hilarious, you know? It makes sense that this is not rural poor people too, you know? I mean, even the militia stuff, my understanding is largely driven in suburban areas, you know? I mean, the people showing up with AR-15s at state capitals around the country, Democrats like to think that every redneck hick has an AR-15. I don't think they know how much an AR-15 costs. An AR-15 is very expensive. I mean, the cheapest is like $750. Most of them are $1,000 to $2,000, right? So the idea that these are like poor rural rednecks that are driving their $100,000 pickup truck loaded up with AR-15s to state capitals to, you know, menace folks is just wildly incorrect. But in terms of, other sort of right-wing lone actors, I mean, actually, the White Rural Rage guys discuss a few in the book. They discuss the Pizzagate dude who showed up to the Pizzagate, you know, quote unquote pizza parlor with an AR-15. And they discuss the folks who tried to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer, right? And they use those to imply, like, the threat of, you know, rural people who believe these conspiracy theories might carry out these dangerous acts of domestic extremism. The problem is none of those people are from rural areas. The domestic terror group that they mention, not from a rural part of Michigan, is from a suburban part of Michigan or metro part of Michigan. The two people that they mentioned that were arrested for trying to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer, once again, both are from metro areas. The Pizzagate gunman guy from a metro part of North Carolina that is, you know, right outside of Charlotte. So I think, like, when you actually look at a lot of the examples of domestic terror, particularly that's, like, let's say Trump inflected, those are mostly suburban and urban. And I don't want to speak too much out of turn, because this is some stuff I read a couple weeks ago. But if I remember correctly, too, one of the important distinguishing points of, like, Trump inflected, you know, extremism. And to be clear, I'm not saying, like, the Trump voter as an extremist, but, like, you know, the part of the Trump voters who are extremists, those are people much more likely to be suburban, upper class, etc., as opposed to more, let's say, traditional domestic terrorism, which historically was actually often more rural, right? So if you look at, like, Timothy McVeigh and that kind of, like, that iteration of domestic terrorism, that kind of stuff was more concentrated in these rural places. But this sort of the Trump version does not seem to be.
Right. The question I have around that is, I think that what they did was that, and you mentioned this, is that they basically couldn't figure out what rural meant for themselves. And they wrote this book and they just decided, well, anything that's defined by as rural by anything, we're going to just go with.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting. You gave me homework this week and you said that I should look at on this thing and see if a place that I thought was rural is actually rural.
Yeah.
And I actually had a very good place, which was where my parents live, which is, you know,
oh, nice.
In rural, what I consider to be semi-rural, Washington State, it's interesting because they are, if you can take a boat and you can get to a suburb of Seattle and it's only a 20-minute boat ride.
Oh, crazy.
But
would be Bainbridge or Vashon.
It would be.
Yeah,
but
hell yeah.
But you do have to take a boat.
Yeah.
And on the island itself, it is quite, it's quite remote. So based on this database that you sent me, they say that it is has been designated by the FORHP as rural.
Yeah.
It is not located in an urban area, and the RUCA code is 10. Does that mean that it's quite
rural? Oh, that's very rural.
Okay.
Yeah. 10 is the most rural. Yeah.
Okay, because one of the things when I was like thinking about it with what you were saying, right, was basically I was like, there's part of me which thought, and this is just that this is not because it's you, obviously, you're my friend, but it was just a sort of basic skepticism that one has. I was like, well, is Tyler the one that is being a little bit too, like, you know, is he the one that's being a little bit too harsh on this? Because, you know, we all know what rural is. And that maybe some of these places, like, if most people saw them, be like, that's rural, but like, by some definition, they're suburban, right? But I will say that I always thought that my parents lived in a pretty suburban area, you know, because it's like, it really is literally, you can take a 15-minute boat ride and you're in Lynnwood, Washington, which is like, has a fucking mall and an H Mart. There's an H Mart there. That's how you know it's rural. It's actually a huge H Mart there. It's a 10 on the RUCA code, which I was just like, okay, well, look, if that's considered rural, then the places that they must be screwing up that are like a 1 on the RUCA code, they must be nowhere close to rural at that point.
Yeah, you know, so I think my gut instinct, and they did not, they basically said we deferred to whatever study we used and however they defined rural. But the problem with that is like there are a ton of different ways to define rural. And depending on how you define it, you get wildly different populations. So if you use rural self-identification, which is, you know, do you live in a rural place? A huge percentage, in fact, some studies say a majority, up to like 70% or more of people will misidentify the like objective rurality of where they live. So they'll say, oh yeah, I live in a rural place, but it's actually suburban, right? So if you use studies that use self-ID, you're getting a very different population than people who, if you look at just like geographic or objective rurality. And it would have been like, they could have made a very good case, right? Like in terms of thinking about Trumpism, what matters is who thinks of themselves as rural, right? Whether or not, no matter where they live, right? And I think that would actually be really reasonable. Or they could say, because of the outsized electoral college influence, we're going to focus on places that are objectively rural, blah, blah, blah. But the problem is they mixed a bunch of these different kinds of metrics. But in terms of what you're talking about, Jay, I mean, the distinctions, like some of the pushback I've gotten has been like, okay, like they made these errors in the section about political violence that are just like objective errors. But like, are you being too hard on them with like the RUCA stuff? And like, you know, like some places that like, you know, I had someone email me that was like, well, you know, I'm from Jamestown, Michigan, and actually is quite rural. Like, look, you know, there's not a lot of stuff nearby, but it's 20 minutes from Grand Rapids. And one of the things that actually really matters if you talk to political scientists are things like, are you, so for example, I got into an argument with someone on Twitter about whether Lewiston, Maine, where my college is rural. Lewiston, Maine is a city of 50,000. And they're like,
it's
no,
definitely not rural.
Exactly. But they're like, no, it's rural. And a lot of people just mean, when they say rural, it's like an aesthetic, and that aesthetic is shitty place where white people live, right? Like that's what they seem to mean.
It's,
you know,
kind of that.
Because there's no chance if you said, if a city of 50,000 that was largely Black and Hispanic, they would call that urban, right? They wouldn't be like, oh no, that's rural.
Right.
So there's like other stuff going on there.
So like some of the places in like Southern Connecticut, for example, where that's predominantly Black and Latino, they would never say it's a rural
city.
Right.
Yeah. So, but like to illustrate why this matters. So like, say your argument is like Lewiston is rural, and there's cultural stuff about Lewiston that is definitely like rural coded. I wouldn't dispute that at all. But in Lewiston, you are a 5-minute drive to the hospital. If you go to somewhere like Pownal, Maine, which is slightly more rural, you are a 20-minute drive from the hospital. If you go more north, you're a 45-minute drive. And then if you're in northern Maine, you might be a 2-hour drive from a hospital. And that really matters, like how far you are from resources, which is why there's this code that goes from 1 to 10 to like quantify different gradients of rurality, because, you know, that difference matters, like the hour versus 2 hours, or the, you know, whether your police response time is 45 minutes or 10 minutes, right?
Right.
both places might, you know, Jamestown, Michigan might aesthetically look pretty similar to some places that are properly rural. But the difference is if you live in Jamestown, A, it's a, you know, a commuter city from Grand Rapids. You have access to healthcare, you have access to culture in Grand Rapids and everything else that you don't have if you live 2 hours from the nearest city. So, you know, it can seem pedantic, but they, those distinctions really matter. But again, you know, I would say as well, if they wanted to put forward a vernacular definition of rural, right, like not the definitions political scientists use, but if they wanted to say, like, look, political scientists are too strict in how they think about rurality, and it prevents us from seeing this, like, cultural homogeny across different kinds of places that are, like, rural and some that are suburban but have these, like, rural cultural affiliations. So we're going to define rural in this different vernacular sense. I think that would have made a really interesting book and would have been totally fair.
No, you don't.
No, I probably don't. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't have written a 3,000 word review, yeah. You know, exactly. Calling him a moron.
Exactly. You would have had less leverage to go at. Exactly. You would not have found it to be an interesting book.
No, but I wouldn't have read it, but I also wouldn't have, like, you know. Yeah.
No, listen. I just want to keep you honest, despite agreeing with you.
You're totally right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I still would have thought it was stupid. But...
Okay. Yeah. Danny, so, go ahead.
No, but it wouldn't be fair.
Yeah.
So, Tyler, let's just say if we replace rural with suburban, what is the actual danger here? Like, what is, as someone who's really delved into this, is there an actual danger of the overthrow of the Republic? Is the actual danger random acts of violence? Like, what is the scale that we're talking about? Because I think that how one answers that question would affect the first half of this conversation about, like, is it useful to identify or not identify fascism? So someone has looked at this, like, is there an actual danger here? And if so, what is it?
So I think some of the experts I talked to would give a slightly different answer than I would. I think my gut instinct, and I don't want to speak for Pape, but, like, reading between the lines of things he said, I think he sees a danger, because one of the things his study found is that there are 21 million Americans who agree that the election was stolen from Trump and that restoring him by force is legitimate. That is actually a lot of people. And so I think he would say that, you know, that's this, like, if even a fraction of those, even if several million of those people mobilized, it could cause real problems, right? And so I don't want to speak for him. I think my sense is he would be more amenable to the argument that, yes, there's a real danger of, I don't know, he never used the word fascism when we spoke. And so he used, I think, authoritarianism, et cetera. So I think he might say, yes, there's a real danger of, like, systemic political problems and anti-democratic changes that could flow from this. My personal view is I'm more persuaded by, you know, and I said in the article, I think we should be worried about political violence. But I'm more worried about, like, the lone acts or the small groups, right? Like, what happens when, you know, of those 21 million, and the thing, I don't want to minimize the idea that restoring Trump by force is, you know, legitimate, because it's horrifying. But at the same time, most of these fucking people are not going to grab their AR-15 and march anywhere to return Trump by force. Like, that's ridiculous. They're like, I think some of these people are identifying with, like, a vibe or a sentiment, you know? But even if some of them, which I'm sure some of them do, believe it and choose to act on it, that could cause a really huge problems, and we should be worried about it. And so, you know, I mean, one of the other reasons I'm not sympathetic to, like, we're in the middle of fascism, blah, 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 is that there was real political violence and killings and assassinations in the 60s, you know, and, like, we are not seeing assassinations and political violence on the scale we've seen in other decades, right? So I think if we're not even at that, like, 1960s threshold, it's harder for me to feel like there is this creeping threat of fascism. But I do think there's a real danger of, you know, lone terrorists, you know, particularly if, you know, Trump doesn't win, carrying out acts of violence. I think that's something to be concerned about. How concerned or how much we should expect, I'm not sure. But I am more, my concerns after talking to folks are definitely more about the lone acts of violence or the small groups rather than, like, 2.0 January 6th that is more effective.
Right. We saw it. I mean, that's an ongoing political question that I don't really know how to resolve in my own head, which is that we have this constant alarmism that goes on. It feels like a lot of the alarmism is somewhat justified, but that it takes on such a catastrophic tone that sometimes it's like, for example, do you remember when people were saying, like, oh, every ballot or every Like, there are going to be people with guns intimidating voters every polling station in Arizona or whatever state Pennsylvania that they decided on, Pennsylvania. And that just, it didn't really happen, right? There was a sense that, like, that certain states that had elected right-wing state constituencies would just by fiat overturn election results. That also didn't happen. And so then there's like a point of exhaustion that people get to, I think, at least people like us get to, right, who have different politics in MSNBC, where we're just like, oh, and Danny, I acutely feel like you feel this type of exhaustion, right, which is just like, okay, well, make it real once outside of January 6th, right? Mm-hmm. And their argument, which I do find kind of compelling, is that that's enough, you know, like that's January 6th is enough to prove that it can happen. But in terms of
but Jay, just a quick question. Happen, yeah, go why ahead. Isn't January 6th proof that it can't happen? It happened and then it didn't.
Right.
That like to me, right, like, they, maybe I'm just being too historical, but if I'm looking at
I mean, it could have gone a lot worse, right? Like it could have, like they could have found AOC, they could have found could have found Mike Pence, like that, and then they could have enacted a level of political violence that would have risen to what Tyler was talking about before and been much more traumatic, I think, for the country.
But that's still not, even if they found AOC or Mike Pence, that's not overthrowing the republic. I mean, like, this is what we're talking about with fascism,
but
right?
We're
like,
not talking... All right, I'm outside of that argument.
Okay, sorry,
right,
my bad.
I'm basically just saying that, like, it's hard to understand what the threat of political violence is going to be, because we can't actually, by definition, when it is stochastic or when it is lone wolf stuff that Tyler, like, it's hard for us to envision what it's going to look like, right? Like, it's like, well, what is it going to be? We couldn't have actually pictured storming the Capitol, even though we had spent 6 years, five years just screaming about what of the political violence that was coming. Like, nobody was like, they're going to storm the Capitol, you know? Like, they thought it was going to be like you always envision it by the last thing that happened, right? So they envision it by, like, probably like Timothy McVeigh or something.
But what about Madison, Wisconsin? I mean, like, this, there have been stormings of Capitol buildings beforehand. That was the left-wing one, if I recall correctly. So, I mean, that's just to play devil's advocate, right?
Right,
capitals have been stormed before. In Seattle, I remember Kshama Sawant led a storming of City Hall.
Yeah, I remember,
you know,
that.
Like,
yeah,
so there are do you see what I'm getting at, though?
Well, one thing that Robert Page that he kept saying was that was a sticking point for him, was that it really matters that this is not poor, unemployed rural people, because he says that if you look at a lot of previous right-wing terrorism, a lot of the people in, like, domestic militias, et cetera, are unemployed or underemployed, et cetera. So they don't have much to lose. And when you don't have much to lose, it's much easier to, like, get wrapped up in these kinds of movements. But the reason he kept saying to me over and over is that it really matters that you need to understand these are, like, professional class, business owning, petite bourgeois, right wing extremists, is that these are people who have things to lose, businesses to lose, political careers to lose, medical practices to lose. And they're so motivated that they were willing to, like, risk all of that, you know? And so a huge sticking point for him was that the, like, class of these people really matters, because what we should be concerned about is, like, the number of people who have things to lose that still went to the Capitol on January 6th, because it speaks to a degree of ideological fervor that would seem to indicate that some of these people, at least, might have been comfortable, as you were saying, Jay, like, you know, doing whatever to AOC or, you know, Mikey Pence, et cetera.
Yeah, it's hard to, I mean, I think that that's why the book is a failure, and why it was frustrating to me, was because, like, there is a better version of this book that could have been written that wasn't just about rural white people, that was trying to resurrect the boogeyman of you know, and it doesn't have to be like a William Volman book where it's like 20,000 pages about what political violence is, right? Has anyone read that book?
Parts of it, aren't there like a billion volumes too?
Yeah. I think it's legitimately 10,000 pages long, but
yeah, I think that's right.
But there could have been an interesting book that was written about what this violence, where it actually seeds itself and how. And that is the part of the book that, like, it seems to shed no light upon that at all, really, right? Like, because, and that's something we don't know. I mean, we don't know why kids in the suburbs, you know, decide to become radicalized, everyone has access to 4chan. So it can't just be 4chan, right? Like it has to be something else that is compelling the kids into those types of spaces. And so, and by the same right, we don't know what compels one car dealership owner to go to January 6th and not the next dude who owns the car dealership next to him, you know? And so it's going to the same tired response. It's because they're racist and because they're rural and because they're stupid and uneducated and they're not like us. Like, that's wildly disappointing. And I think that the last thing before we got to log off here in a second, but the last thing I want to ask both of you is that I think the three of us here, right, despite I think what is a real disagreement about fascism or whatever, right? Although not as pitched, I think, as some of the other disagreements that happen on this about this thing. I think that the three of us are interested in one idea, which is there a way in which the popular front can be the idea of a popular front or whatever can be reconfigured, that it contains some of the people who are actually economically downtrodden, that it is not just an upper middle class PMC type of movement that basically screams at everybody who doesn't fall in line with what is an upper middle class suburban type of liberal sensibility, right? And that, can we bring people like the people that you grew up with, Tyler, into a fold of a type of economic populism that, you know, is not racist, xenophobic, or whatever, mm-hmm. and is about shared prosperity, right? Like, I think that's a good way to just kind of briefly summarize something that is there. And so I guess the question that I have then, to have, you know, having written this, right, like, how, where do we get to the other side of this, right? How do we get to the other side of it? It's something I think about all the time. It's just like, shouldn't demonize these right wing mm-hmm. or these rural people, especially these rural poor people. And yet it seems to be so ubiquitous at this point where you think it's fading. Like, there are times when I think it's fading, and then they just do it again.
Yeah.
Totally. Well, it's inherent to the ideology. Modern liberalism emerged out of a form of turn of the 20th century progressivism that was very focused on leading the basically governance by experts. Right. Right? So it is foundational. It is one of like the four things that make modern liberalism modern liberalism. So that's a tough thing to overcome.
Right.
Like, the way that I always think about it, if you remember a certain magazine, The New Yorker, in the wake of Trump's election, I believe published a cartoon where it's some like guy who represented white rural rage on a plane in a mustache saying, "Let me fly the plane. Yeah, I know better than the pilot." Right. And that to me is like liberalism encapsulated. So for it to get to that sort of popular fronty place, I think you need to have like a radical reformation of liberalism itself, which is not happening right now, to say the very least.
Yeah. That's obviously true, but I want to hear from Tyler, because this is really like, I don't know, this seems to be the thing, at least in terms of your political work, right? Not your academic work, that seems to be front of mind for you. I think that you rightfully get upset because people that are supposedly on your side, and since I'll just say it, because you are black, they think they're doing it for you.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
That they're just saying pretty fucked up shit about people that you grew up with.
Yeah. I wrote white moral rage for you.
That's what they think. That's what they think, right? Like, that is the idea, right? It's not to protect them. Right, yeah. It's to protect you. Sometimes me, but not always.
You know? And I'm being ungrateful. Yeah. No, I mean, this is one of my frustrations, is that there is this narrative that I've seen a lot on Twitter that, you know, oh, this is like an argument, the white rural rage debates between different white guys. And that's just not true. I mean, you know, there are a number of folks of color, Musa Al-Gharbi, who was on the show recently, who have criticized this book, People Are Immigrants. And so I find it really frustrating. And I think part of the reason why I really do think like the rancor of the debate is in part because like the MSNBC crowd thinks they're like defending me, you know, and then when folks of color aren't grateful for that, it causes all sorts of issues. But in terms of like the project, I mean, I spent a lot of time studying the history of the American right, and the Republican Party in the post-war period was really, really good at cobbling together groups with vastly different interests and incentives, whether it was anti-communist immigrants from Russia and the Soviet Union, evangelical Christians, suburban, you know, suburbanites and Wall Street guys who wanted their taxes low, whatever. Those aren't groups like evangelical Christians and Wall Street groups, Wall Street, you know, people are not like they don't have much in common. Yet the Republican Party knitted together this coalition. And I, my frustration is that the Democrats are just not, and the left is, I mean, saying they fetishize purity politics is shopworn at this point, but it's nonetheless true, you know? And I just think we need to be able to cobble together a coalition of people who want to change the economy, who might have different views on cultural issues that we can fight about and not agree with. But, you know, I think if we're not going to have a left coalition that is like suburban moms and like, you know, benevolent, you know, Wall Street Democrats, and then, you know, some folks on the left, then I think we have to find some people who are on like the sort of slightly right of center, who are populists, that are working class, that we can have some kind of coalition with. You know, I mean, I, someone I admire a lot, I disagree with him on a bunch of cultural issues, but is someone like Sohrab Ahmari, who, you know, wrote Tyranny, Inc. recently. Like, I think there are people that are, you know, want to return to some kind of New Deal politics. And I think I don't agree with him on any cultural issues, but like there has to be some kind of space on some kind of like popular front for people who we might disagree with on cultural stuff, but that we can, you know, join in a shared sort of economic vision of the future. And I think constantly getting stuck on places where we disagree rather than focusing on like, what is some economic messaging different parts of the political spectrum can get around, and how do we formulate a movement out of that? That seems to me really important and, you know, beneficial. I mean, a thing I say all the time is, you know, I cannot see a single thing that has gotten better since George Floyd, right? We had this huge, you know, uprising and attention focused on anti-racism and blah, blah, blah. I mean, just taking my work in academia, not a single thing has improved. Adjunctification has gotten worse. The casualization of labor has gotten worse. Nothing has improved for minorities. And partly the reason nothing has improved is because the economic situation of universities has not improved, right? So tuition continues to go up, and we keep, you know, adjuncting labor and so on. And so my point of view is maybe we need to cobble together a coalition with people we might disagree with on cultural issues, but the economic improvements would like improve the lives of a lot of people, of folks of color, et cetera. So I don't know. But I think that's a question for after, hopefully Trump loses and Biden returns or maintains.
I know that's a, some people
on the hold on the office.
Some people on the Discord got mad at me because I just said at the end of the podcast with John, I was like, we kind of just have to get through this election, you know? And I was like, well, I don't know. It's not something I would usually say, but I do think that we kind of have to ride with the suburban mom PMC benevolent.
Yeah. No, for
it's just
sure.
Very hard to figure out what the other idea.
I will
just,
ride
just
with the wine
Danny,
moms for now.
As yeah. You cringe, I'm saying this in terms of electoral politics.
Only. No, not at all. I mean, it's just. I mean, for me, it's like I think it's like the locus of politics is like in this thing that's called the state, and it is so difficult to affect. And to me, this is like the number one problem of the 21st century. Is that like we really are alienated in like an original Marxian sense, which is precisely what the man himself said would happen if capitalism wasn't tamed. I mean, we cannot control it anymore. It is outside of human control, and we spend all of our time. This might be it's a little cranky. It's good. Let's end the piece on a crank, on like a crank note, not cranky. But like. All of this stuff with politics and coalitions, like the decision points are not necessarily with the people who we elect.
No.
It's like dispersed throughout this impossible to control system that isn't like headquartered in one space. It's all around the world, and it's, you know, not subject to the human will. We're totally alienated from it. I mean, Yanis Varoufakis, I forget how to, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, which is on the Politics Theory Other podcast. And he's like, yeah, like the problem is that we don't control anything. So we're spending all our time talking about this. And of course, in some sense, it does matter. Obviously, that Biden wins over Trump. It does matter. It's not just like they're the same. But all this like talk about the politics of the day, I think sometimes occludes from where real power lies.
Oh, yeah. I think about that all the time in terms of homelessness here in California and how much people talk about what can be done. And at some level, there's very little that can be done. And yet there's enough to make it basically not get worse, you know? And that, right. that's where I think most people who understand this are just like, all these billion-dollar laws that are passing, everything like that, that they're going to be quite limited in what they can do,
mm-hmm.
because there's seemingly, it feels like, no way to bring the price of housing down in the state. And there's no way to restore the mental health facilities that were there that, you know, were ripped out.
Yep.
And that, you know, we just don't have the workforce to do any of the stuff that they try and do anyway. So, like, we can elect anyone to be the mayor of San Francisco, but their like, the amount of power that they actually have is quite limited. And it's just so weird. And I'm guilty of this too, right? It's just weird that we think about the difference being the person that we elect, because no matter what their prior politics are, it's like almost impossible for them to do anything about the biggest problem that everybody thinks is the biggest problem. So,
right. And this is why all the billionaires want to go to space, right? Like JP Morgan could like put his hand in the economy and do something, right? These guys can't, and it makes them crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know, that's why I had this, I keep thinking about this. You have the all in podcast guys, right? Like David Sacks and Chamath. And it's just like, these dudes just want to be me at some level, you know, like they want to have like, or Tyler or you, like they want to basically have some thing where people have to respect, like that some of the people who go to parties with them kind of have to respect their opinion because of the affiliations that they have with some media thing, and that they're like writers or they're bloggers. And I think you're right, Danny. It's because they realize that they like, things that are important to them, like how do I clean up downtown San Francisco from all the, like they can't do anything about it. Elon Musk, who at some point was the richest person in the world, he can't do anything about it. So then when, like they just like, well, it must be that if I buy this messaging platform, then I can have some actual influence on the world. But in the end, like, no, I'm sorry, you can't.
Can't even get rid of the sex bots.
Skynet has become self-aware. Right?
You like, want to literally. Be me? like, I'll tell you, you know, I have no influence on anything. I don't know what you think, you know, but like, none of us do.
No, not at all.
And like, you thinking that because your billions of dollars don't have any real effect, that now you should become a blogger.
Just opine.
You should become a blogger, and that's how you have real effect. It's crazy. It's so funny.
Wild, yeah.
Anyway, I'll trade with them if they want.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, anytime, guys. We're open for business.
Yeah.
Anyone on this pod can be bought. Let me repeat. Exactly. We can all be bought.
I will trade places with you guys in a millisecond. Oh, that's, you know, right. I'll just
surf all day.
Seriously. What would I do?
All right. On that note, thank you for listening to the pod, Danny. Thanks for coming on, thanks, Tyler. Thank you. I'm glad that this is, I thought, was fruitful and fun. We will. If you'd like to support the show, it's $5 a month. Goodbye.substack.com or patreon.com/ttsgpod. If you'd like to email us, it's timetosaygoodbyepod@gmail.com. Yes, until next week. Talk to you guys soon.
Cheers.